So you can go ahead and turn to Genesis chapter 12. We're going to be looking at chapter 12, 13, and 14 today. And yesterday, as I was wrapping up my message, I thought to myself, it was a bad idea to try to cover three chapters. But we're going to try. We're going to try today. Jenna joined her high school drama club, and she was thrilled to land a role in the upcoming school play. And on opening night, she was there in the backstage, sitting there nervously waiting for it to begin, when a senior came in and came over to her and said, "Jenna, break a leg." And she was new to all this, and so she had no idea what he meant by saying, "Break a leg." And so after thinking about it, she decided that he was a senior. He knew better. And so Tom must have meant that she needs to be very dramatic tonight. And in one of her scenes, she needs to go out and literally fall and break a leg. And so when the first scene came up, she took a deep breath and staggered out dramatically onto the stage and fell to the ground holding her leg, grasping it. And the audience gasped, because they were wondering what was going on. They thought that she had really broken a leg. And so all of a sudden, the curtains close, and the director runs up to Jenna, and Jenna nervously admits that she wasn't injured, actually. She decided to do what Tom said to do, which was break a leg. And at that point, the director and everyone else burst out laughing, and it was only then that Jenna realized what the expression meant. In theater, when you say, break a leg, it's good luck. And with that in mind, the title of today's message is what is perhaps, I'm thinking of, is probably the greatest sermon title I've ever come up with. And that is, yee-haw, and oh my. And you may be wondering, am I at church or am I at an Andy Griffith show rerun? And today's message, as I said, we're going to be covering three chapters of Abraham's life. And in these chapters, we're going to see Abram go through, and I'm going to say, I told you this last week, I'm going to say Abraham and Abram, same person. We're going to see Abram make some boneheaded decisions. And some of those decisions are also going to be good decisions. So he's going to be good, and he's going to be bad. And as I studied each of chapter and each passage here this week, I started categorizing sort of what each passage represented, or whoa, you know, that kind of stuff. And I turned it into the sermon title. And so it's going to represent a range of expressions, because that's Abram. And Abram is going to be doing some good and some bad. And so we'll be going through this, and then afterwards, I'm going to do my best to talk about where Christ is in these chapters, or in the chapter that I'm going to be focusing on. And so we're going to start out chapter 12. We looked at verses 1 through 9 last week. We're going to start out in verse 10 today. And Danny, by the way, can you back up that projector? It's zoomed in too much, that one there. So it leads to the expression, uh-oh. So this is one of those stories that you're going to look at, and you just go, uh-oh, you know, oh, no. And so let's start in verse 10. "Now there was a famine in the land, and so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land." Let's stop there. Now let me ask you, in this verse that we just read, where do we see God telling him to go to Egypt? Well, I'm going to let you in on a little not-so-secret here. He doesn't tell him to go down to Egypt. There's nothing there where God says, go down to Egypt, there's a famine. Instead, what we see is Abram makes a decision out of fear. And so let's just back up and remember where he is in this story. And last week we saw that Abram made a huge decision to follow God, a huge step of faith to follow God out of his home country. God called him out of there and to go into Canaan. And so he followed him over 1,500 miles all the way down to this new land. And so he was in Canaan, and he was right where God had told him to go. He was in the middle of God's will, I would say. But then something bad happens while he's there in the middle of God's will, and that is a famine. And so food gets short, and Abram panics. And as I shared last week, there's no grocery stores or anything like that. And so you had to eat either what you grew or what you bred, or you could eat something that you traded for based on what you grew or bred. And so a famine was a huge deal during that time. And out of fear, Abram makes this rash decision. Oh, you know, famine, let's get out of here. And so he basically runs out of town down into Egypt. In verse 11, and so when he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, I know that you are a beautiful woman in appearance, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. And then they will kill me, but they will let you live. And so say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared. By the way, this is the beginning of why wives don't listen to their husbands, right here. And so to summarize the rest of the story, the two follow this stupid plan. And so the gorgeous 65-year-old Sarai... Hey, you all are laughing, not me. I was very diplomatic in how I said this. The gorgeous 65-year-old Sarai is brought into the house of Pharaoh. She's then likely, we're not given what happened, but likely she's sort of added to the group of other women who are headed or destined for Pharaoh, and sort of in a training phase. And so she's there, but most likely she hasn't been touched yet by Pharaoh. And in return, Pharaoh then gives Abram a lot of servants and animals. So Abram becomes a very rich man based on giving his wife away to another man. And so at this point, God then steps in. He's like, uh-uh. And he sends some plagues against the house of Pharaoh, which, by the way, foreshadows what's going to happen in Egypt many years later at the time of the Exodus. And so Pharaoh gets the message that he shouldn't be doing this, and he returns Sarai to her husband, and then sends them out of the country. He basically tells them, get out of here. Go away. I don't want anything to do with you all. And so Abram, though, we see keeps his wealth. And so he doesn't return what he's given. So he leaves Egypt a wealthy man. Also, by the way, foreshadowing what was to happen later on in Egypt when the Israelites leave Egypt with all the many gold and possessions of the Egyptians. So this is a big uh-oh moment for Abram. And his failure, though, is a good lesson for us. And so let me just sort of think about this by way of application. And I want to encourage all of us to not let fear overtake God's leading. So this could be that maybe God's calling you to go somewhere or to do something, and your fear is saying, uh-uh, no way. It could be that God is leading you to talk to a friend about Jesus. So it could be that God is leading you to stand up against something sinful at work. Or it could simply be that it's obeying Scripture to get a particular sin out of your life, and getting rid of that sin puts fear in you. And so whatever it is, and there's a number of other situations that could be, I want to encourage you, don't let fear take over or control what God is leading you or telling you to do. So Satan would love for you not to share Christ with your friends because you fear what their response might be. Satan would love for you to move away from God's will out of fear of something. So here's the reality, though. We all do this at times. We all do this. We all mess up from time to time. We all give in to fear from time to time. But when we do, let's remember the story of Abram. And we can remember that when we mess up, God is still in control. This is not a reason to intentionally go and mess up more. But God is in control even when we seemingly ruin the plan. So God fixed things in Abram's situation in an instant. In an instant. Even more amazing is the fact that Abram leaves Egypt better off financially than how he was before, even though this whole trip was out of fear. And so it's one of those amazing wonders that God can do, where he can take a plan that we mess up and turn it into good. So God is still in control, even when we mess up the plans. Now moving on to the next section, we're moving on to the expression, chapter 13 now. Abram and his family are back in the Canaan. And thanks to Egypt, Abram has a lot more flocks there, animals. He's a rich man, and because of this, they have so many animals that all the different family members are starting to have this tension about what to do. So verse 8, then Abram said to Lot, let there be no strife between you and me, and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if you take the right hand, then I will go to the left. Let's stop there. Which direction to choose? So Abram must have learned something from his time in Egypt, because now he's confident that God will provide no matter which direction he goes in. And so he leaves it up to Lot to choose the direction. And verse 10, Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. And this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot sees one direction, and it's this beautiful land with grass everywhere. It's flushed with greenery, which is good for food for the flocks. However, that direction is also near the wicked city of Sodom. In fact, it's so wicked that the author, Moses, points out in verse 13, now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. They weren't just a little wicked. They were great sinners against the Lord. They were super wicked. So Lot chooses to go in that direction, and Abram then goes in the other direction. And after this, all takes place. God then tells Abram that he's going to give him all the land, which is sort of ironic because he just gave Lot sort of that direction. But God then comes to him and says, Abram, I've promised you the land, and you're going to have everything. You're going to have everything. And then he also reaffirms the promise to give Abram a lot of heirs. And by this time, you know, it's another year or so after moving, and still no kids. So then in verse 18, so Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. And so the last verse shows us just the contrast between Abram and Lot, and really how far Abram has come and learned from his lesson. So Lot chose what was good for the eyes. He chose what was practical. And in doing so, he willingly put himself right near the wickedness of Sodom. And in the next chapter, we're going to learn that not only did he get near the city of Sodom, but he actually moved into Sodom shortly after. But Abram, in the meantime, what is he doing? He's going in his direction there, and he's worshiping God. So he's clearly, he's grown in his faith. And so there's one thing that I just want to point out that I want you to take away from this passage. And that is, choose carefully whom or what you will let influence you. So the choices that you make today are going to impact the direction that your life is going tomorrow. So if you put yourself under the influence of sinful friends, then guess what your likely destination is going to be? If you go and are fixated on sinful material, whether it be music or books or TV, then guess what direction your life is going to head? There's a pastor that once told me that I was at a conference, and he said, "Do you want to know where your life will be in 5 years? Then look at the friends you're hanging out with right now and the books that you're reading." So in other words, what you dwell on through friends or study or anything else, that will impact the direction of your life. So if I may speak to the young folks here, choose carefully the friends that you're going to be close to. Choose carefully, because the ones that you're closest with are the ones that are going to influence you, and you influence them, and that will impact the direction of your life. Choose carefully, young folks, the music that you're going, that you listen to, and the books that you dwell on, that you read all the time, because they will impact the direction of your life. Now, moving on, we get to a very exciting chapter, and this is from with the expression, "Yee-haw, yee-haw." And I almost put just "yay," but "yay" is sort of boring. "Yee-haw" is more exciting, and it sounds more adventurous. And this is a very adventurous passage. So in verses 1 through 7 in chapter 14, we get a little bit of history. And I'll just summarize what those verses say. So the passage says that there's these four kings in that region, and they attack five kings. And one of those five kings is the king of Sodom, and they defeat them. And so then the five kings now are sort of subjected to the four kings and have to pay money or like a tax on a regular basis to the four kings. But after 12 or 13 years, so after about 12 years, the five kings are tired of being under the rule of the four kings, and so the five kings rebel. So they go to battle, and the five kings lose the rebellion again. And then the four kings are now probably upset that they rebelled. They go on a rampage through the area to sort of show their strength. So the four kings, they take the supplies from the people, and instead of just leaving them there to charge them a tax, now they take all the people and bring them up with them, probably to turn them into slaves. Verse 12, we also learn that they took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and they also took his possessions, and then they went away. Now, this is an uh-oh moment, but hold on, because the story is not over. Verse 13, then one who had escaped came and told Abram, the Hebrew. We'll stop there. So someone escapes, goes to Abram and tells him what's happening. And now we have the makings of an action movie right here. I don't know why this hasn't made its way to Hollywood yet. Russell Crowe has another movie in the future. So two chapters ago, Abram fled for his life out of fear fled from the land that God gave him, and gave away his wife, who was told that would produce an heir. So that was not a good chapter for Abram. But now, two chapters later, chapter 14, he goes on a rescue mission with not a lot of people to go up against four kings. So verse 14. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobal, north of Damascus. And then he brought back all the possessions that he also, and he also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and the people. Yeehaw, right? This is an adventure. This is a big change for Abram in two chapters. Now, for the sake of time, we need to move on to the last section. And so this last section gives the expression, oh my, oh my. And we see in verse 17, so Abram has defeated the invaders, and he's now, let me just read what happens next. Verse 17, so the king of Sodom went out to meet him, verse 18, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. By the way, I'm not even going to mention this again, but who else in the Bible talks about and uses bread and wine? Well, let's just think about that. Verse 19, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. Oh, my. Oh, my. Out of nowhere, this character named Melchizedek appears. And he's described as the king of Salem. By the way, that's what will later be called Jerusalem. And he is the priest of God Most High. And this is odd because if you know a little bit of your Bible, you know that we're in Genesis. And the priestly system, starting with Moses' brother Aaron, has not been set up yet. And so then Melchizedek blesses Abram. This is also odd, because Melchizedek, we know nothing about, but Abram, as I talked about last week, is one of the biggest characters in the entire Old Testament. And yet, who's blessing who? So Melchizedek is blessing Abram. It comes from the greater to the lesser. And then on top of that, Abram then gives a tithe to Melchizedek, a tenth of everything. Oh my. Now what in the world does all of this Melchizedek stuff mean? And this is where we get to the question that I ask every week as we've been going through the series, and that is, where is Christ in this passage? And I read about this week about a woman who created the windshield wiper. It was in 1902. She visited New York City. Her name's Mary Anderson. And she started to notice in New York City that when it started raining, that everything got very chaotic. And so people would lean out the window trying to drive, or they might reach around and try to just brush off the glass with their hand as they're driving, which obviously was not very effective. And so when she returned to her home in Alabama, she worked with a designer and created the very first windshield wiper. And it was then patented in 1903, and the patent, though, ran out in 1920 because it wasn't very popular. So it wasn't until 1940, so 20 years after that, that the windshield wiper finally became standard on a car. And what Anderson was doing in 1903 was identifying a problem that is called an invisible problem. These are problems that we don't even know we have. Problems that we don't even maybe think about very much. So it's often things that we've accepted as normal when there's actually a better way out there. And so in Genesis 14, in the story of Melchizedek, what's happening is that it's pointing out another invisible problem. It's one that we don't often think about. And the problem is this, that we all need a good priest. And this idea is explained more in Hebrews 7, which talks about why Melchizedek is important and why this priest idea is important. I'm going to admit that this is a little bit tedious. A little bit tedious, so try to hang with me. And hopefully by the time we get through the next couple minutes, you're going to have a better understanding of why Melchizedek is important and why a priest is important. But this will also help you better understand Jesus. And so let's remember what a priest is. A priest is one who stands between God and the people. And since God is holy, we've always needed someone to be that intermediary between sinful people like us and a holy God. So now back to Melchizedek in Genesis 14. We've already seen that Melchizedek is this king and priest of God Most High, but he's outside of the line of Abraham in Israel. So he's not in the priestly system that will come from Moses and from Aaron and sort of down that line in Israel. We don't know much about Melchizedek, but Hebrews 7 is now going to explain why this guy is important. So let me read the first three verses. For this Melchizedek, the writer of Hebrews says, king of Salem, priest of God, of Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him, Abraham apportioned a tenth of everything, a part of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, king of righteousness. And then he is also king of Salem, that is, king of peace. He's without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. But resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. So there's some people that look at the idea of Melchizedek and say that that's Jesus Christ coming down as Melchizedek. But Hebrews tells us that Melchizedek resembles Jesus, but he's not Jesus. So Melchizedek is sort of this picture of Jesus. And we've seen a lot of pictures in Genesis so far of future people. And Melchizedek is a picture of Jesus Christ. But then going on to verse 7 of Hebrews 7, the author says, it is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. So Hebrews is saying that Melchizedek is greater than Abraham and Israel's priests. And why is that? Well, as I already explained, because Melchizedek blessed Abram. And it always comes from the greater to the lesser. But then, as we saw, that Abram also gave a tithe or 10% to Melchizedek. And since Abram gave a tithe to Melchizedek, Hebrews says in some of the verses I haven't read, that that because Abram had the heirs, that was eventually Moses and Aaron was the first priest, and that sort of down that line, since Abram gave the tithe to Melchizedek, it was sort of like the priests of Israel gave the tithe to Melchizedek. So all this points to the superiority of Melchizedek. So with this established, Hebrews then talks about the imperfections of Israel's priests. He says, now if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, meaning through the priests of Israel, for under it, people received the law. What further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? So, in other words, Israel's priests were not able to save people. So they brought in the law. They established the law, that priestly system. But there was only so much that a priest in Israel could do. And what they could not do was save people. And so the priests oversaw this sacrificial system, which then represents the law, all the works, the things that we do, like the good works, which then cannot save people. So to fix this, we needed a change in priesthood. So verse 12. For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well. And this came from the change of priesthood through Jesus Christ. So speaking of Jesus in verse 10, verse 17, quoting from Psalm 110, Hebrews says, you, speaking of Jesus, are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So not the order of the priest or the line of Abram. Jesus' priestly order comes from a different line. And Melchizedek represents this priestly line that's outside of the messed up, sinful line of priests through Abram. So this means that Jesus is a greater priest than Israel's priests. And because of that, if we follow Jesus, then we have a greater high priest. In fact, we have the greatest priest. So just because we are not Jewish or just because we're not Catholic does not mean that we don't need a priest. We all still need a priest, but we need a better one, and that is through Jesus Christ. So how is Jesus a better priest? Hebrews continues. Verse 22. This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. But he holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. So Jesus' priesthood is permanent. So with Jesus as our priest, we don't have to worry about him dying or messing up. He is forever. He's here to stay. And because of that, Hebrews says, consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy and innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like the high priest, to offer daily sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests. But the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son which has been made perfect forever. So Jesus is the perfect priest. And Hebrews says that this perfect priest takes it even a step further in the next few verses. Because not only is Jesus our priest, but Jesus is also our sacrifice. So he gave himself to pay for our sins. And so we, as we think about Melchizedek randomly popping up in Genesis 14, this is not a coincidence. The writer of Genesis, Moses, is pointing to there being another order of priests beyond Israel's priests. And Jesus' priesthood comes from that order. Because Jesus is the great high priest, we're under a new law. Because Jesus is the great high priest, our salvation, when we put our faith in him, is permanent. Because Jesus is the great high priest, there's only one sacrifice ever needed, which Jesus did by sacrificing himself for us. So everything changes when Jesus is our high priest. And all of it sort of goes back to this mysterious priest that appears before Abram in Genesis 14. Let me close with this. I read about a Christian woman who was dying of lung cancer in the hospital, in a Catholic hospital. And as she was laying in bed, every breath was filled with pain. And so she was just quietly praying under her breath. And the nurse came into the room to check on her. And she could tell that her time was just about to end. And so the nurse asked her if she would like for her to call a priest in. And the woman in bed turned to her and said with a raspy voice, "Thank you, but I already have a priest." And that just about sums up what I've just tried to say for the past half hour. We already have a priest, and he is the great high priest. 1 Timothy 2:5. "For there is one God, and there is one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus." So he is our great high priest. He is able to save all who come to him. And therefore, wouldn't you agree that he is the one who deserves our worship? He's the one who deserves our devotion. And so I'm going to encourage you, wherever you're at, give your entire life to him. If you've never put your faith and trust and hope in him, do that now. The Bible says that if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, and believe in the heart, in your heart, that God raised them from the dead, that you will be saved. That's your way of starting that turning to him. So turn to him, give him your life. So let's go ahead and let's spend a moment now in prayer.